Bienvenidos a la segunda temporada de Encuentros, un podcast para disfrutar del espacio Fundación Telefónica, donde y cuando quieras.
Algunos de sus libros han sido prohibidos o censurados, y sin embargo sus historias parten como si de un experimento sociológico se tratara, de tomar el pulso y recoger puntos de vista auténticos sobre los temas más polémicos. Él es Chuck Palahniuk. Arrancamos. Sus obras siempre nos dan que pensar, nos llevan a lugares incómodos y logran que nos hagamos preguntas. Pero cuando conoces cómo trabaja y cuál es su método, tan pegado a la realidad, resulta todo mucho más inquietante. Porque aquello que tú no concibes de ninguna de las maneras, resulta que es muy posible para muchos y en absoluto descabellado. ¿Qué ocurriría si las teorías conspirativas y las fantasías separatistas intrincadas en parte de la sociedad estadounidense se impusieran? Esta es la nueva tesis que nos plantea en El Día del Ajuste, editado por Literatura Random House. El autor del Club de la Lucha conversa hoy dentro del Foro Telos 2021 con la periodista Marta Fernández en una charla que, al igual que sus obras, nos deja pensando. Tanto más como él mismo hace antes de responder a muchas de las preguntas. Esa honestidad carente de artificio, las ideas en las que basa su obra, el saber cómo representa ciertas corrientes, sus propias opiniones sobre la actual agitación social o lo que para él es la buena literatura, todo nos lleva a tener muy en cuenta cada palabra que escribe o dice. En esta ocasión en inglés, pero puedes escucharle también doblado al castellano en nuestro canal de YouTube. Que lo disfrutes.
En cierta ocasión,
once Robert Stone said Chuck to Chuck Palahniuk, "For something to last, it needs to be made in granite or with words." Well, Chuck Palahniuk has managed to build with words a work that will last as if they had been made in granite. 25 years ago, he published his first novel, and he has been surprising all his readers ever since. He's a wonderful guest for this forum, where we're going to be rethinking the future. He has always impressed us and marveled us and dazzled us. He has stirred us while reading his work, and he has managed to make us ask ourselves questions, and we're going to ask him about his last book published in Spain, Adjustment Day. This is the quintessence of Palahniuk. He has everything that we love about his work, the characters, the plot that drags you inevitably. Obviously, there's a manifesto, because all big events require their manifesto. There is a mysterious list and a deadly list, and there's people willing to be part of a community almost at any cost. Thank you, Mr. Palahniuk, for being with us today. There's a moment in the novel where you say that the joy of fiction is that it only has to smell true, but reality ends up smelling having the same smell as your work, as your fiction work. Are you a visionary, or is it that you are a good listener to what's going on in society?
My degree from university was originally in journalism, and so I do not invent very much that goes into my fiction. Most of what I write about are ideas that I hear repeated from other people. What they see wrong with the world and how they see the world needs to be fixed. So I sort of combine the fantasies of a lot of different people. And that's where my fiction comes from.
You have a degree in journalism, and I have heard you say that you don't like being inspired by current events, but sometimes it looks like the world really likes to get inspiration from your work, and all of the people who have read Adjustment Day thought of this when we saw the assault on Capitol Hill on the 6th of January, when you saw this character with the bison skin and the chest visible. Would you have thought this was too far-fetched if you had written that before?
I thought that would have been too theatrical and too, as you say, too far-fetched. What happened on January 6th seemed much more symbolic than what I depicted in Adjustment Day. There's an old phrase that history repeats itself first as tragedy. And what I depicted was a tragedy with everyone being killed. But then it repeats itself as comedy. And so in a way, what we saw with the insurrection on the 6th was a kind of comedic version of what I had depicted in my novel.
En el día del ajuste,
in Adjustment Day, at the beginning, you have a quote by John Adams that is very revealing, that it says that, remember, democracy doesn't last for long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. Does democracy carry within, as a virus, the germ of its own self-destruction?
That's such a big question. It would be completely speculation, but I have to wonder if democracy doesn't scale very well. If democracy works very well for homogeneous populations with like-minded goals and relatively small populations, but once you start to scale it up to larger and larger groups of people, I don't think democracy works as well as it did.
Señor Palahniuk, quizá uno de los...
Mr. Palahniuk, one of the dangers for that threatened democracy is the lack of freedom of expression, censorship, and you have mentioned that when you brought Adjustment Day to your usual publisher, they didn't want to publish it because they thought it might be too dangerous, and you thought even, you considered publishing it yourself in Amazon. You being Chuck Palahniuk, maybe we've become too much of a Puritan?
My last two or three books have been very heavily censored and banned. And normally that would have been a kind of badge of honor to be have your book banned. But these days, having books banned doesn't seem to mean anything. So, yeah, it's hard to comment on that. Yeah, it's getting your books banned now is just a pain, just a difficulty.
Hablando de eso, de libros que pueden ser...
And talking about that, books that can be forbidden. For an author who likes his readers not to be numb and to be actually stirred by their work, this new wave of political correctness, is it a bless? Is it a damnation, or could it be a blessing because it brings the reader closer to the abyss?
On one level, I completely support the new wave of any kind of change, because I think every generation has to kind of change the terms of the game. They know that the game was invented by the previous generation, so it could win. And so every new generation has to change the game so the new generation can win. And so right now, what we're simply seeing is that young people are changing the rules of the game so that it's their game. And I'm all for that. I'm all for inventing the game over and over. And I also understand that the people we see sort of asking for trigger warnings and safe spaces and a lack of provocation are a generation that has been exposed to so much provocation their entire lives, so much conflict. And you can see them wanting to demand peace, because, you know, the John Lennon generation, its biggest demand was peace. Everyone demands peace. And peace just happens to look differently for every generation. Right now, peace looks like a kind of complete suppression of conflict, a complete suppression of traditional forms of power, and complete control of the narrative. That's what peace looks like. And for my generation as a child, peace looked like just the absence of war, just the absence of open warfare between countries. So I don't think what we're seeing right now is entirely a new thing. People are just really tired of being gratuitously provoked and exposed to upsetting things. And they're trying to curate their lives, I think, trying to find some peace.
Hablando de los...
Talking about young writers, do you think that a new writer right now could publish a book like Fight Club at the moment, or would it be forbidden?
Right now, well, since September 11th, since the attacks on the World Trade Towers, the kind of book that Fight Club was, which depicted transgressive acts as a means of creating something new, those transgressive books have been really condemned as terrorism. So right now, I see the culture veering much more towards traditional genres like horror and fantasy as a way of exploring new societal models. And so basically what Fight Club was a kind of model for society that was depicted until it broke down, and then we would study how it broke down. And that's the same case with Adjustment Day. It's just a kind of a fantasy wish fulfillment for a lot of Americans, you know, going through with the idea of what if we did have a civil war? What if we did break the country up into at least three different, much more narrowly defined countries? What would that look like? And what would be the subsequent problems of that? Because I think if we can cathartically go through that fantasy and see it to the point where the fantasy begins to fail, then the fantasy will be a lot less attractive to us. And so rather than writing Fight Club, I think people are writing horror, they're writing fantasy, they're finding other ways of dealing with this, either the wish of what society could be or people's horror over what they can't resolve right now.
En el libro hay una interesante...
In your book, there's a reflection about the power of hatred, and I've heard you say that we cannot underestimate frustration. Is there more hatred, more frustration after the pandemic, after the lockdowns, the crisis that came afterwards, the prohibition to travel, etc.?
I think there's frustration because people can't fulfill themselves through the traditional model, which was to acquire a stable household and to begin a family and to begin acquiring financial assets. And so people have discovered a more rootless way of living where they need very, very little. And that's fascinating. It's kind of rediscovering a kind of migratory way of being that we've left behind, you know, 200, 300 years ago. And I don't see that as a bad thing. I think that's kind of fascinating because I think most of our ancestors were migratory people. And so I think that's very interesting and very similar to what I saw people going back to in the late 60s, early 70s, when people went back to farming in small sort of alternative communities and hippie communes. I think we're just kind of seeing a version of that.
Es muy interesante esto que dice sobre la...
It's very interesting what you say about this frugality and the return to that type of life. In your novel, you write, hoard food and it rots, hoard money and you rot, hoard power and the nation rots. How can we realize that we are rotting, if we can at all?
This is the part where I have to think. So, sorry. You know, one aspect of an awareness of you know, stagnation is, are people still pair bonding? And are people still having children? I think that would be the chief indicator about whether or not the country was still moving forward and viable. And if that's not the case, then I would say that that's an indication of rot. Beyond that, I'd have to think a lot longer.
Bien.
When your first novels were published, you were labeled as a generational writer. However, time has proven that all your work have called different generations, because there's something very deep in your work, and the cross-generational issue is very present in the Adjustment Day. Where are we failing the next generations?
Well, in the past, we seem to have had a lot more open space. We had places where outliers could go to. If people didn't fit into society, there were big, open, sort of frontier places they could go to. And those people could live more solitary lives and kind of discover themselves, discover their own abilities in isolation. But nowadays, we live so densely that we don't have those kind of outlier places to send people to. Originally, people were sent from the East Coast of America to the West Coast, where they could isolate and they could create their own social model. But we don't have those places. And now we have more of a virtual sort of frontier where people can get together online. And that's not very fulfilling. So I'm kind of fascinated by all of the protests. I think in a way the protests are not just a cathartic exercise. They're also a laboratory in which the leaders of the future will emerge, that people will distinguish themselves. The most extreme people will be killed, or they will kill themselves. But the people who can distinguish themselves in these kind of domestic battles are the people who will emerge as the next generation of leaders. Much in the same way that in previous overseas battles, a generation of leaders would always emerge. And so I think in a way, instead of having Vietnam be the place of war, our cities are currently the place of war. And it's from those battles that our next generation of leaders will emerge. So again, I think it's completely organic and something not at all new to the American sort of political system.
The beginning, you were talking about this journalistic approach when you write your novels, because you like your characters to be made of flesh and bone, so there's nothing better for this than to listen to the real people. So you embed yourself in groups to listen to them and to find your inspiration. But my question is, when you arrive at these groups, don't they say, hey, here's Chuck Palahniuk, we need to be more reserved? Aren't there any reservations when you arrive at these communities?
I think it's exactly the opposite. There are these kind of tawdry tales about how when Truman Capote would go to sex clubs, where he would not have sex in New York, but as people recognized that Truman Capote was having sex, they started to perform as if they were porn stars. And they might be having very lackluster sex, but once they realized that they were being watched by Truman Capote, suddenly they would cry out and their performance would become this over-the-top, just dramatic, overly dramatic performance of sex. So in the way that Heidegger always said that the observer heightens the performance, I think when people recognize that I'm listening to them tell their ideas or tell their experience, I think they're more likely to express themselves and to try to perform for me, because they want me to remember their idea. They want to be depicted ultimately in my work.
Do you find that these people are really willing to express themselves, that they don't have anybody who listens to them, and that they are really grateful for you to be there to depict their stories?
I think so. And I think also because they know that because of the nature of what I write about, I don't judge my subject matter, and I'm not using my subject matter to make an obvious point. I'm not really politicizing what I'm writing about. I'm not dictating its meaning. And so people feel that they can sort of trust me to honor their story and not to turn it into something else.
Señor Palahniuk,
Mr. Palahniuk, in your novels, it's very important the way characters fight to connect with other characters, with other people. There's this need to belong to a group, to have a structure, to have certain rules. Maybe we as readers are caught by these type of situations because we are solitary beings when we are in front of our books.
I think there's a big part of the solitary, you know, I think that that's a very good point. Thank you for making it. That reading is a solitary activity. And so when a writer writes, I think a writer should write about people in a group, because you want to connect the reader to at least one other person, if not to a larger group that the reader can feel part of. And also that readers and writers tend to be people who are, that shy away from conflict, that writers are these reclusive people because they cannot be with tension, they cannot be with conflict and hostility. But what I'm presenting them with is a very safe, structured, consensual way of experiencing conflict and violence and hostility in a mutually agreed upon sort of activity. And so they can just get their toe wet and they can sort of develop their ability to be with conflict so they don't feel so frightened in the world. I think that's the same for both readers and writers. They need a safe way to experience conflict so they can get used to it.
Pero usted como escritor...
But you as a writer, as an author, you're a solitary person, but when you look for inspiration, sometimes I get the impression that you're like trying to find water and you're trying to find where society is actually buzzing at the moment. So inspiration is actually a social activity.
It starts with the isolation. It starts with me identifying a fallacy or something unresolved in my life. And I find an anecdote from my life that illustrates that. And I'll take that small story to a group setting and I will toss it out as a topic of conversation. And at that point, I see whether or not it resonates with a lot of other people. And if it does, then people immediately start to talk about their own version of that event in their lives. And that's how I develop the idea, is by using the experience of a vast number of people who've all experienced the same unsettling, unresolved event, but have never been able to really talk about it. And so it's starting for myself, but then taking that personal experience and seeing if other people have had that experience, and then collecting as many versions of that experience as possible, and then turning it into a larger sort of quilt.
Ya que estamos hablando de escritura y...
Since we're talking about reading and writing, I would like to highlight mention the books that we can find in Adjustment Day. There are many and they're very important. In fact, the axe of the whole novel is the Blue Book, but there's also the Quran, the Bible, the Mein Kampf, Oedipus the King, Great Gatsby, To Kill a Mockingbird, etc. A good book, could it be the most powerful weapon in your view?
A lot of Adjustment Day was based on the ideas of a German scholar named Gunnar Heinzen. And Gunnar Heinzen proposes that most social change throughout human history has come about because we've had a surplus of young men who have all been educated and well-fed, and because they're second or third sons, they won't necessarily inherit a place in society. They won't inherit a business or a title. They won't inherit property. So this surplus of sons, according to Gunnar Heinzen, has to go out and cause trouble in the world in order to distinguish themselves and have the hope of achieving property and position and being able to create a family. So Gunnar Heinzen said that the Spanish and the Portuguese sort of circumnavigation of the globe and exploration of the world was based on this enormous number of second sons who were all raised well and all educated well, but for whom there really wasn't a place set for them in society. They had to go into the world and create that. The same way with the British Empire, the same way with the French Revolution, the same way with the Arab Spring, that anytime there is a kind of surplus of young males, and we could very well be seeing that with this the massive immigration of refugees into Europe, that they, for the most part, are young men who are looking for better economic positions. But Gunnar Heinsohn said they always need a book. And the book may not be especially bright or valid, but it has to be a book that they use as kind of their blueprint. And so for the surplus Germans, it was Mein Kampf. And for the conquistadors, it was the Bible. It's just a book that validates this surge into the world looking for success, looking for resources. And so there's always a book like that, Uncle Tom's Cabin, a book that kind of provides people with a framework, Mao's Little Red Book, that it provides them with a kind of justification for what they're already doing.
No quiero dejar de mencionar.
I wouldn't like to ignore or skip two very important authors, Steinbeck and Bradbury. And I never realized that The Grapes of Wrath and The Martian Chronicles are very similar in their structure. And you mentioned that when you realized these structural similarities between the two books, you started writing Adjustment Day.
Oh. Yeah, they are kind of, they're both these kind of dream quests to a new homeland, this kind of fulfillment of a fantasy of moving to a new place and having a great new life, and then taking that to the extent where it begins to break down, which people sometimes call romantic fatalism, where people have a goal, they achieve the goal, and then they find out that the goal was really a disaster. So in both Martian Chronicles, people end up stranded on Mars as the Earth is destroyed, and they have miserable lives on Mars. And in Grapes of Wrath, people end up getting to California, but then they find out that California was just kind of a huge, miserable trap for them. So in a way, I was doing the same thing with Adjustment Day, where, again, people decided to fulfill a fantasy, and we take that fantasy to the point where it breaks down.
Por cierto, en el día del ajuste también hay reflexiones.
By the way, in Adjustment Day, we see very interesting reflections on schooling and journalism. And I quote, schooling had given people very little in exchange for their money, and the media had not given people anything in exchange for their time and their attention. Can we not trust anymore on the institutions that usually helped us to become better informed and better educated?
You know, again, what I depict is very much relies on what I hear from people. And I hear from generation after generation when they get out of school that they were taught very few useful skills. That they get out of school and they have a lot of debt, but they don't have a lot of things to bring to the market. So I hear that frustration a great deal, and I was just trying to reflect that frustration. And more since the internet became so prevalent, people have really begun to question what their media is telling them, because media seems to have kind of moved away from just giving us facts and allowing us to make decisions about those facts to giving us this kind of partisan opinion. And people have become kind of bored with hearing other people's opinion. This is as much as I can say on it.
En este mundo de las fake news en el que el
In this world of fake news where journalism has become less credible, Can we think that fiction authors are the last refuge for trust and credibility?
I'm not sure if I would say trust and credibility. I would say dealing with issues indirectly, and by dealing with them indirectly, dealing with them more effectively, because you're not out there banging a drum and saying abortion is good or abortion is bad. You're writing a book that explores the topic, but isn't necessarily making it about abortion. Books like Rosemary's Baby, which are so much about women's healthcare, and it just takes the idea of women's healthcare to this incredible exaggeration that a woman could be raped and that her beliefs prevent her from having an abortion, even though she suspects she's been raped by the devil, and her healthcare insists that she take all these drugs and eat all these foods that just support the devil's child, and her doctor refuses to let her have any say in her care. And that's really on the footsteps of the whole thalidomide disaster, where women very much trusted the healthcare system, and the healthcare system told them to take the sedative thalidomide, and these women ended up having severely deformed children. Yeah, children that were deformed much in the same way that the devil's baby is described to be in Rosemary's Baby at the end of the book. So I think in a way, Ira Levin's book is such a classic because it allowed people to kind of indirectly take a look at the issues of women's healthcare, abortion, and thalidomide. It wasn't really about good and evil. It wasn't really about the devil. It was about all these societal issues that were so incendiary that we cannot talk about them directly. And so I think that's what good fiction does, is that it finds a metaphor that allows us to kind of exhaust our emotional reaction to a controversy. And by doing so, we can move past the controversy and we can resolve it in society. So fiction is not about telling us what's right and wrong. It's about kind of making us look at these things and to the point that we're no longer fighting about them.
In Consider This, you say that as readers recognize truth when we read it in a book, and that it really is appealing to us and it's revealing to us. Maybe this is why fiction is so important, and because all these things that you're saying, because it looks into the metaphors of society to speak the truth that we wouldn't be able to say otherwise.
Exactly. And it's charming. It entertains us. It really baits us into going to a place that we would not voluntarily go to. And I think that's what good fiction does.
Por cierto, quería...
By the way, I wanted to ask you about Adjustment Day. There's a point in the book where it looks like it's not well looked upon to be learned. Is this happening already in our society? Is culture related to the elites and it's becoming something to be suspectful about?
I think overall, you could establish authority, and I can only talk about books. It used to be you could establish authority in a book and you could make the reader believe you if you provided a whole collection of very esoteric facts. And anymore, facts are so readily available that all you have to do is go to Wikipedia, and suddenly you have so many strange little facts that people no longer recognize that kind of intellectual authority, because they see how easily it can be kind of faked or it can be kind of cobbled together. And now, I think the much stronger form of authority is when someone, in my case, a writer, can arrive at an emotional truth or an emotional vulnerability that that causes an undeniable emotional reaction. That is the new and that is the more effective authority. That kind of intellectual authority is now so questioned because of the internet that that people have gone to the emotional authority, which can never be questioned. It made you cry. It made you see the world in a different way. It made you happy. It made you laugh. People cannot argue with the fact that it made them laugh. And so that emotional authority is the new supreme authority. And the intellectual authority is almost entirely sort of disregarded.
Se habla mucho de sus personajes.
Male characters are very interesting, but your female characters are very powerful too. In Adjustment Day, we have Shasta Sancheth, a new kind of Scarlett O'Hara, and she is Hispanic. Can you tell me a bit more about this character?
I, in a way, the Shasta is the only kind of reasonable character who isn't kind of wrapped up in one of the big political movements. She is the outsider character who is not carrying a gun and looking to start a new nation. And that ultimately, when she is pulled into one of the new fiefdoms, that she destroys the man that she's forced to marry and she escapes. I think a lot of the characters are powerful. But, you know, Shasta is just a smart character.
Una de las cosas más importantes.
One of the most important things in fiction is the surprising factor, the awe factor. But in a world where we're living, where reality seems to imitate fiction, has it become more difficult to surprise your readers?
I'm thinking, it's just a long, slow, silent thinking. I don't think it's more difficult to surprise them because the world is so constantly changing and there's so many new things coming into our awareness all the time. And it's just a matter of looking at these new things and finding a way to flop them or to use them in a very unconventional way. Or of taking a very ancient thing, a very ancient legend, and sort of updating it with new metaphors. And there's always a new generation of readers who haven't seen that story. So you can endlessly reinvent older stories with new circumstances, or you can take new things and then twist them to your own ends. So I wouldn't say it's any more difficult. In fact, it might be easier now because there's just so many more elements in play.
There's another constant in your work that has to do with readers. You never underestimate us. You always give us an active role in our reading. And also, you always treat your readers as intelligent beings. Would you say that in the current fiction, and I don't only mean literature, but also series and TV shows, etc., would you say that all these new media underestimate the reader?
I would. And that's why I enjoy very little contemporary media. But I can see that they have to make back their production costs by reaching as large an audience as possible. So they have to say everything three or four times. They have to be repetitive. They have to be expository. They can't trust the reader to to sort of stay abreast with what is being shown and to make the right connections. So they really do have to cater to the largest number of people as possible. And in a way, that's why I write books, because I just couldn't be with that kind of thudding repetition.
En el taller de escrito.
In the workshop Dangerous Writing by Tom Spanbauer, you were looking for those things that embarrassed people, those things that people are afraid of, those people where it's scary to tread into. To be a writer is painful. Does it need to be?
Ultimately, it needs to be, but not at the beginning, because the reader will not start a book that is painful at the beginning, and the writer will not finish a book that is painful at the beginning. So the beginning needs to be attractive and charming and engaging and compelling, all of those things. And then the book needs to gradually grow more complicated and darker, and charm the reader as well as the writer into going to more and more challenging places, until ultimately the reader and the writer have arrived at a place that they never voluntarily would have gone. So that's still Tom's Dangerous Writing. It's still dealing with a topic that is very upsetting and unresolved, but it has to be very charming at the first. But otherwise, no one would go there.
Se ha dicho de usted que es un escritor.
It has been said of you that you're a cinematographic writer, but I've always wondered because you have a visual capacity in your writing, or because your novels are like as if you were part of the making of a long movie. What would you say, or is it a mix of both qualities?
It's not something I do deliberately. I think it has a lot to do with coming from a journalistic background, and then also coming from the style of minimalism, which was created by Gordon Lish and taught to my teacher, Tom Spanbauer, that in journalism, you can't use pejorative language. You have to sound as objective as possible, and you have to allow the reader to make those kind of pejorative judgments. And the same goes with minimalism. You cannot use language that that tells the reader how to think. You cannot dictate emotion. You have to create the circumstances on the page that allow and kind of prompt the reader to come to the emotional place that you would like them to arrive at. And so in both minimalism and journalism, you have to be more cinematic. You have to be more objective.
Además del periodismo.
Besides journalism and minimalism, at a certain point you get in touch with comic and graphic novel. Has this influenced your writing?
It has. It influences it more structurally, because when you're writing for graphic novels, they're just the way the story is presented. Forces you to write so that you have certain plot points, certain reveals every two pages. The theory is that as the reader turns the page, the reader scans both pages. So you cannot surprise the reader with that two-page spread. That at the bottom of every right-hand page, you have to have a setup. So that when they turn that page, the payoff has to come at the top of the left-hand page. That's the only place where you can really surprise the reader. So really any kind of shifts between plots or shifts between characters or surprise payoffs have to come at the page turn. And so that forces you in writing graphic novels to write according to a very strict, dense plotting model. You have to plot so densely so that you can surprise someone every two pages. But that's just one of many, many things in graphic novels that are structured differently than prose fiction.
Hay un momento en El Día de la Lucha.
There is a moment in Fight Club where the narrator realizes that the groups that they have created, these followers that they have run out of control. At any point, yourself, Chuck Palahniuk, have felt that your books were running out of control and that the readers were out of your control as well?
Not really. I feel a great sadness there here in the United States. There was a Korean, Canadian young woman named Alyssa Lam, who apparently was a great reader of my work. She quoted my work a lot in her blog, and her body was found in the rooftop water reservoir of a hotel in Los Angeles. She was disturbed. She hadn't taken medication, and she seems to have subsequently drowned herself. And I felt extremely sad that she was dead. I wish I had had a chance to meet her. Yeah, I wish her life had gone differently. And more recently, with the Gabby Pepito murder, suicide, with Brian Landry, his body being found, they were both very public readers of my work. In fact, one of my books, Lullaby, was sort of tied into this possible idea that they'd taken this trip and that Brian Landry had murdered Gabby Pepito. And that made me enormously sad also. Somehow I wish that I could have met these people and that their lives could have gone differently. And I think it's just, I think it's just the hazard of living in the world. I could live a very small life in which I would have interaction with very, very few people, but it would still be a small life, and I could limit my exposure to tragedy and human suffering. But I would much rather live a much larger life, even if that means a greater exposure to unhappiness, because it balances out with having a larger, better life, and it balances out with having a greater exposure to people's success and victories and happiness. So, yeah, I hate living in the world.
Another influence of your books in the readers is that some readers have wanted to become writers themselves when reading your books. When you started writing, you looked up on the writers that you liked, like Scott Fitzgerald or Stephen King, until Spanbauer told you that there was also already a Fitzgerald and a Stephen King. What would your advice to the new writers be right now?
You know, I would always go back to the reason why I started writing myself. Is that at one point I could no longer find books that I wanted to read, that there were really no books that grabbed me from the first page. And so rather than give up on reading, I thought the only responsible thing to do would be to try to write the kind of book I would like to read. And as so many people have been in lockdown over the last year and a half and have been more or less limited to being sort of fed streaming, being fed these stories from television and the internet, a lot of those people must be really sick of what they've been seeing. They're seeing these mass marketed stories that have to reach millions of people in order to make a profit. And so because of that nature, they may not be the best stories. And so I would bet that a huge number of people, young and old, are so sick of what they've been seeing, you know, served to them through the media, that it's time for them to try to write the kind of story that they wish was in the world. That you can complain all you want about nothing being on television or not finding the books you want to read. But at some point, you have to move past your complaining and you have to write the thing that you wish was in the world, or you have to make the film that you wish was in the world. And I think that we're just at that place because of the lockdown.
Eso es un gran consejo. Por cierto, que hemos hablado.
That's a great advice. We have talked a lot about Adjustment Day. We are here in Madrid, and I believe that part of the inspiration for this novel came to you right when you were in Madrid, in our country. Is that right?
It is. It was 2014, and I rented an apartment and lived in Madrid all summer, and it was terrific. I loved it. I love Madrid because everyone works there. It's not like Barcelona. It is a city where people are working and it's beautiful. Just everything about Barcelona, I adore.
Hay un momento...
Oh, everything about Madrid, I adore.
Yeah.
I was like, I got that wrong, completely wrong. Everything about Madrid, I adore.
Hay otro momento.
There's another moment in Adjustment Day where you say, "The measure of a man is not what he does for wages, but what he does with his free time." Can I ask you as a last question, what do you do on your spare time?
My spare time is still my writing time. I still think of my writing as my kind of spare time hobby. And so I'm always looking for places to be stuck where I have nothing to do but writing. In fact, I've started a program called Study Hall, where I rent out a big hall one night a week, and people from all over come there just to write, because there is nothing to do but sit at these desks and write for 3 or 4 or 5 hours. It's very much like school. And these are young people and old people who just want to be away from the distractions of being at home. And so they can come for one evening a night and just write in the presence of other people who are writing. And so writing is still very much my spare time.
De verdad le digo que a mí me gusta.
I can honestly say that I would love to join you in those workshops to write with you for a while, but I cannot do it, and I will then keep reading your books. Mr. Palahniuk, thank you so much for being with us in the Foro Telos, Rethinking the Future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for all of your patience. I'm so sorry I failed you last week. Thank you.
Encuentros, un podcast para disfrutar del espacio Fundación Telefónica, donde y cuando quieras.